I'm Corey Grushka, the founder of Stories Bureau, a creative agency that specializes in storytelling and multimedia creative for all things insights.
And I'm Simrat Sarin, a marketing expert with over 15 years' experience in helping the biggest brands create true memories.
I want to inspire you to think bigger, broader, and more creatively.
And I want to push you to make you think and go beyond the job description.
Let's get started.
Here's an interesting story. So, elevators, right? We love elevators. The biggest challenge with elevators is they're always slow. No matter what you do, you know, raise capacity, do whatever you want, they're always slow. And in the race to try and make the elevators faster, it doesn't help because people start to get motion sickness and all of that fun stuff. So this genius of a person comes up and says, why are we trying to make elevators faster? Like, what do you mean? Just put a mirror when people are waiting for elevators. Guess what people do when they're waiting for a freaking elevator? They look at themselves and time goes by because there's nothing prettier than you. And that psychology of consumers on what they actually value and what actually makes a difference is, I think, at the crux of a customer experience. Because it's never about, hey, how do I get this faster? Or how do I do this better? But it is, how do I make the experience that they want? And I'm super pumped about the guest today. Because in a world where you are flooded with customer data, this is a guy who has come in and changed the company and moved it forward one anecdote at a time.
I think the audience is really going to enjoy this conversation today, Samra.
Hi, I'm Alex Ganov. I specialize in customer experience research, market segmentation, and user experience design. I have a doctorate in experimental social psychology and bring this perspective to understanding customers as human beings. I've been applying this to various businesses for 25 plus years in different industries ranging from insurance to personal finance to B2B. Most recently, I was in retail as the head of customer experience research and marketing insights for Zappos. I'm also a keynote speaker and author of the book, Forget the Customer, See the Person.
Zappos is really an interesting place in that it's been, I think, an early pioneer on the understanding the customer experience, and kind of like promoting the interests of the customer. It's, you know, interested to hear your thoughts about the DNA in the company.
What's in the DNA of Zappos is real customer centricity, and the real pioneer spirit was this realization early on that Zappos is not going to win through the biggest selection necessarily early on to, you know, everybody was used to buying shoes in stores and so on. So they realized they're going to win through really a great customer service approach. And that was a very counterintuitive decision at a time when everybody was cutting that cost. And even to this day, everybody's trying to minimize this cost and save money on customer service. The team said, no, we're going to double down there. In the Zappos ethos, that came from an early anecdote where this woman bought shoes online and she expected them for some wedding or for some occasion. And they didn't arrive on time and she was very disappointed and wrote to Zappos. So imagine back then you're a startup, scrappy startup, right? You get an email from a customer. They could have easily said, forget it, that's to be expected. Don't worry. No, what they did was they overnighted a pair of shoes for her. They apologized profusely and they sent her a coupon. And they get an email back from her with the subject line, wow. And this is so many years ago. And so that started Zappos on this path to customers, on customer centricity. And of course, they then developed this great selection and this great company culture, essentially, that is based on the spirit of hospitality, which I'm a big fan of as an analogy and as promoted by this great New York restaurateur, Danny
sure.
Meyer. You know, he wrote the book Setting the Table, and he's talking about hospitality being this system, not just for, you know, restaurants and hotels, but for any business. And he defines it as being on your customer's side, or when something happens for you, not to you.
Yep.
And that was the quintessential Zappos customer service.
I think the Zappos story is fascinating, but your story is also quite fascinating. I mean, you listed a few things. What lessons do you think you learned over your career that you've brought into Zappos? And what sort of lessons do you think you can share with others?
Sure.
Where they would be like, you know, this is how we actually lead in a product-centered company where data is primarily the only currency people talk in.
I mean, there's many lessons there. I would say, my career and my approach have evolved quite a bit. So coming from academic psychology, academic research, my first foray into the business world was in usability. As my career progressed and going from State Farm to Intuit, I was exposed more to product. Intuit is a great product and research and customer-centric, just an excellent, excellent UX company. The founder, Scott Cook, was somebody who pioneered an approach they called the Follow Me Home, which is in the very early days of Quicken. He would hang around the store and see somebody pick up a Quicken box back before the internet, of course. And he would approach him later and say, "Can I come home with you to see how are you using it?" Wow. Right. So that was, he instilled that in the whole company. So we were doing this. It's essentially ethnographic research. It's ethnography and qualitative research, interviews and observations and so on. But that's, I learned a lot there in terms of now UX research and design research and so on. But then one of my best experience was at a smaller startup after that between Intuit and Zappos. It was called the Active Network. So in San Diego, this B2B company started for runners, by runners. So they power all the running events and a lot of marathons. So it's the software behind the registration for a lot of sporting events and so on. So there we had, I worked with really, really excellent people, and we had zero budget. So we did all the work ourselves in terms of now market research and segmentation research. And so what I brought with me was this deeper understanding of consumers as individuals. So the psychology of the consumer. And so what we did was a series of really insightful mindset or psychographic segmentations. So when I went to Zappos, I was ready with all that arsenal of knowledge and tools and so on. And one of my first projects at Zappos was to introduce mindset segmentation, because they had this excellent transactional segmentation before that, profitability by engagement, right? People who are really profitable for Zappos and really engaged, but again, they didn't know the why. So that's what we layered onto that, was this this idea of what motivates you to shop, what are your concerns, right, your attitudes and so on. And then what enabled a lot of that was the very nature of Zappos at the time was very different and very open. So Tony introduced this experiment of self-organization soon after I joined. So there were no more titles, there was no more org chart. I joined as a manager, I was not manager anymore, but people were encouraged to self-organize around important work that laddered up to, that supported the work of the business goals. So in this context, and I know we'll talk a little bit about our Voice of the Customer program a bit later on, but that's how it got started. Because when I joined Zappos, nobody was reading customer comments at the time. So I joined the most customer-centric company when it comes to high-touch phone service. But nobody was looking at the NPS or reading customer comments.
Zappos is ahead of its time a little bit, or at the forefront. From a CX and a customer and into surprise and delight, adding value. Where are we going in that space? I mean, obviously a lot of, you can't have that conversation without AI and the ability to personalize, not just messaging, but that kind of surprise and delight, the touch points, the product, right. The promotions. I guess it's really, the question is, what does customer centricity look like optimally in 3 years, you know? And is there even a conversation without AI around that, you know?
I mean, everybody's now talking AI, right? You have to say AI to get people's attention, right? You can. It's almost like, reminds me of this SNL, the subliminal guy, right? Remember that he says something like AI, you know? AI. So, no, I think it's a great question. I think I would preface that by saying, to me, that's a question of separating the what from the how. And that's, again, I learned that from Intuit. This is one of the best lessons I've ever learned, because everybody's now talking about a how, which is a technology or technique or an implementation. And they're not thinking about the what. So they start thinking about the what after they've signed up all the contracts to implement something. So now what do we do? So chatbot. Oh, everybody's doing chatbots. Oh, we need a chatbot. And then chatbot powered by AI. Oh, even better, we should get that. And then what do we do with it, right? To me, the right approach is to say, let's now take this proven spirit of hospitality and customer service. And again, borrowing from Danny Meyer, he says service is very different from hospitality. Service is this, you need to do what you need to do to keep people happy, but hospitality is kind of going above and beyond and just really wowing people. So you take
service
that.
Service is the floor for what's the burger Shake Shack, right?
Yeah, exactly, like, right.
Service is the floor, yeah.
Exactly.
And hospitality is the experience.
Right, exactly. So I'm excited to bring that spirit of customer service to the digital experience.
Totally.
And then the question is how you do that. But you actually know what you need to accomplish. So what makes the Zappos customer service great? You're not being put on hold. Really great, funny, smart people pick up and start chatting with you, try to create an emotional connection. That's what they're measured on. Not just resolution is, of course, for granted, but they want to create an emotional connection. Ask you for, like, they hear a dog barking in the background. How's your puppy doing, right? They really make you feel comfortable. If you want that, if you don't want chit-chat, they leave you alone. But then what in our research, what we found was that two key ingredients make that customer service exceptional, which is, it's pretty simple but pretty profound. One is to say, I'm sorry, right? We don't pass the buck to anyone else. We don't say UPS or somebody else or the brand, whatever. I'm sorry, and then two, I'll fix it for you. These two things. It's about investment, because you have to back it up with saying, right, I'm not going to pass you on to a supervisor or pass you on three times before you hopefully hang up. But you say, here's, you know, keep the pair, right? You don't have to even return it. Donate it. Or I'll send you one right away. Then you send it right away. It's fixed. It's a big investment.
That mode of conversation, I think, brings up another point, which is really the work that you do in the insight space, in the analytics space, and data. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, your philosophy, I guess, about insights and data science, you know, has found its way into both the organization, but then your team more broadly? Sure. And then I have a follow-up on that.
So no, that's, thanks for asking this. I think it's absolutely essential. So for me, my point is to bring this balance to businesses, a little bit of balance between focusing on just the numbers versus understanding customers as humans. And that is absolutely essential, but it gets lost in this crescendo of excitement of AI. And I look back at history, right? And I'm a student of psychology and a little bit of a student of history. And you look back at the mechanistic age, and it was when, as soon as they invented the mechanism, you know, the cogs, and everybody was in love with that. Oh, that's going to save everything. Even the brain was depicted as cogs. So that was because it was so predictable. You pull a lever and then something happens, and then you get the stuff out, and it's, and now you start optimizing, right? So you have the mechanistic age, then you have the Industrial Revolution, and now we're back to that. It's just the mechanism is the ones and zeros, is software. And we think, okay, we have the numbers, we're good. You feed them here, you know, dollar signs come out of the other end, and you forget that you're dealing with humans. And I think it's perfectly fine to just focus on numbers in certain areas. Like, for example, if you build a bridge or if you're in construction and aerospace engineering, it's all numbers. When it comes to physics and to physical objects and everything, chemistry, numbers. But then you apply the same to people who, you know, consumers or customers. And it starts to break down. And that's the realization of, for example, in economics. Economics is based on math. But then you had to have behavioral economics come to the stage because now people understand that we're not walking calculators and we act on emotional impulses most of the time. So you need to understand customers, you need to understand emotions. And I'll make this concrete for you with an example. And so this was one case where at some point the numbers in the spreadsheet said a lot of our customers shop for their kids but not for themselves. And then the first impulse, of course, is to say, well, we have their email addresses, we'll send them emails, say, buy for yourself too. Good thing we went and did some home visits and talked to a lot of families, a lot of moms. And I discovered for myself, but turns out to be a real phenomenon called mommy guilt. So the quote after quote was, before kids, I shopped a lot. I love fashion. I love shoes, clothing. But after I had kids, everything goes for the kid and I feel guilty buying for myself. And when I say this to speak to audiences and half of the women in the audience start nodding.
That was you uncovered. That was you and your team kind of identified that as a...
We identified that. Exactly. So that was a true insight. And then we bring it to the team and now you can see how you can be much more empathetic and the now the message would be, we know you're a busy mom. We know how you feel and look around, put stuff in your list, right? And maybe on your birthday, we send you a free pair of shoes from that list, something like that. So that would be truly true hospitality and truly generous thing that happens for you, not to you, right? The other one would be one-sided, just buy for yourself too, so that, you know, we get more of it.
One of the pieces of work that I was doing a couple of years ago was looking at a bunch of different e-commerce websites and really understanding the neural of how the brain works while people are shopping. Mm-hmm. And what became evident was people who are designing retail experiences, especially online, have a very different vision of what the buying experience is versus the people who are actually buying off the website. And what right. I mean is, so we did this thing where we asked people who on the design side, like, tell me, you know, the situation in which people are actually buying these products. Mm-hmm. And you would see images of, you know, people sitting on couches, relaxing, right. people, you know, chilling out.
Right.
And like, this is like, they were, it's as if they were at Saks.
Right.
It's exactly right. the same way. Whereas when you look at the neural patterns of people when they're actually buying, it's more indicative of somebody who is sitting with their kids on the side while mm-hmm. they're shouting and fighting over
right.
the TV.
Exactly. Right.
Coffee on top of a laptop while right. they're trying to figure out what to buy.
Right. Exactly.
And then when you talk about design and user experiences, you're like, do you understand what you're designing for?
Right, exactly.
As opposed to what yeah. you've created.
Yeah.
And it was a startling experience. And some of the biggest names in the industry when it comes to e-commerce have solved for the technical aspects, you know, mm-hmm. fast reload times, 1,000 right. products right. on the page,
right, right.
you know, colors that can give you contrasts in the most amazing ways
right, right.
for readability purposes.
Right.
But they actually don't take into account the simplicity of journey that's needed, which literally, in terms of numbers, was people could shop inside a grocery store for 45 minutes. And the same amount of cognitive load was being created within 7.5 in an e-com website. What basically ended up meaning you're going to go on a mission behavior.
Right.
So I'm only going in to buy what I said I was going to buy, and I'm coming out. So
right.
no increase, no upgrades in baskets,
right.
lost revenues that way.
Right.
And I love the book that you wrote, which was, you know, don't think about the customer, see the people. And you put a lot of stories in there of like, when you actually see the people, you start to do things differently. Talk to me about how that, and the voice of the customer program put together in that. Like, how have you been able to bring this to life in a world at Zappos? Yes, the culture already existed, but How did you bring this to life and the challenges that you faced? Because it must not have been easy whenever you're doing something
else. Sure, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's it wasn't easy. It was creating the Voice of the Customer program, which is operationalizing this customer centricity. So one avenue to operationalize customer centricity. I mentioned that when I joined, they were collecting some sort of feedback, sending it to a third party, you know, survey tool, but nobody was reading comments. And to me, that was a double take, like this huge, well-known company, right? Which was obviously very successful developing that without reading customer comments for all those years. But the time had come, I think, to start really listening to customers. And the first team that listened was our 6 p.m. sister site that a lot of people were saying, were asking for favorites, and we didn't have favorites, believe it or not, back then. And then at the same time, you see related problems. I mean, they weren't as obvious, but people putting stuff in the cart, you know, and then you say cart abandonment, but it wasn't abandonment. People were using the cart as a favorites list. And so as soon as we, you know, I shared some of the comments with the team, it was like a lightning hit them. Customers said that, right? And from that point on, we started collecting, and we had many challenges. First of all, you know, the cost started amassing because of the volume of comments. But then more importantly, we needed to really understand what happened in that session when somebody said, I had a tough time, or your site sucks, right? And to do that, we need to collect this an ID that connects the dots. And Zappos, as being part of Amazon, customer data privacy and security is of utmost importance. That that beats everything else. So we couldn't be sending those IDs to, which is because it's sensitive information, to a third party server. So then took me about a year and a half to ask internally. This was in the year of self-organization, right? When we were asked to be entrepreneurial and so on, to ask engineers, can you build me a little survey tool, just a little one page of like three question types? And then finally, one really customer-centric engineer did that in a couple of weeks, and then we were on our way. We started collecting the comments, storing them, and then started sharing that with information with executives. And initially, they didn't know what to make of it. But very importantly, they were saying, don't just report a number to me. Tell me what I can fix, right? Don't just say, oh, yep, the NPS is low or it's going down. And that root cause for customer sentiment was hidden in the mountains of text data, the comments. So now we needed AI. You know, now ChatGPT is another level of AI, but back then the natural language processing engines, and so we had to find a good partner, and after some trial and error, we partnered with a company out of the UK called Chattermill. And then as soon as we started now quantifying that sentiment, turning it back to numbers and reporting it, we got the attention of executives. But it took years and years, and you had different times, some executives were skeptical of sentiment, saying this is just people would say anything, right? But we persisted. Now we have the executive team reading comments. But I'll tell you one anecdote that exemplifies the Zappos culture, actually, which is, you know, I would share both positive and negative comments every week, just a snippet, right? Like a sampling. So I would share the report, but then also give examples, like 10 positive, 10 negative comments. And one time this comment was just very angry, but very like nonsensical. It's, well, does my blah, 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 effing this, effing that, right? And one executive honed in on that, kind of jokingly. And in turn, jokingly, I said, well, you know, sometimes I put these Easter eggs in to make sure that you're paying attention. And then it dawned on me. And then the next time I actually put one I made up one positive comment. I said, I always shop for at Zappos because the CEO Scott is so handsome. And then and then that same executive is like, wow, we need to find that customer again, send her a prayer. And they laugh. And then somebody was asking me, do you still do that? And I'm like, no, I stopped doing it. You should do that. Scott loves that. but you see that that's the it. Other companies, you would be reprimanded, right? What are you doing? You're putting a fake comment in there. You're polluting, right? You'd be reprimanded, chastised, and punished probably.
Yeah, it's that's an interesting anecdote. I want to cover also, you know, this podcast. The goal is to talk a lot about, you know, storytelling with insights, advocating with insights, selling with insights, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
And so even when you do understand the customer, getting to an insight is the biggest problem with insights, right? Getting to a mm-hmm. true business insight is the challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's really the metric you're evaluated by, right? Something that is going to move the needle. But even when you have it, to your point, Alex, about the mommy guilt, it doesn't necessarily find its way into a campaign or into the product. And sometimes you know the answer. So I guess going like more like broader in terms of the idea, the purpose for this podcast, you know, how do you think about socializing your work? Because at the end of the day, you need to create action, right?
Right, Corey. I mean, this the kind of the art of convincing people hasn't changed much in 2000 years. You know, it was was it Aristotle or somebody?
It was Aristotle.
Right? The reason, the
logos,
pathos, and what was the third one? Reason.
Well, pathos is emotion, but
right? Reason, emotion, and something else. That's the so that's the reason is the numbers, right? It's then the emotion is the anecdote. And it's interesting because speaking as a psychologist, you're convincing people. So these executives, the decision makers are people. Sometimes you hear people saying, no matter what numbers you bring in, you're never going to convince that person, right? Because they have made some kind of emotional decision that they're against this, right? So you may have, so that's where the idea of mindsets and their personal mindsets, but they become business mindsets. So for example, everything is in the numbers. Like the numbers tell the truth. People are confused and they don't know what they want. So don't listen to people, listen to the numbers. If somebody holds that belief, I mean, good luck changing it with anything. So that to me is it's an open question for me is, can you really change somebody's mind? They have to be an open-minded person.
They have to see it, right? That's part of the experience with Qual too, right? That's right, the whole reason you're putting executives in focus groups sometimes. They're putting in people's homes, watching them shop virtually, right? It's like, but the question is still, like, how do you create those experiences that have the aha moment for your idea, you know what I mean? Like for your work, right? For your research.
Even if you have the pathos and the, you know, the reason.
The logos
and the pathos.
The ethos.
And the ethos. When you have them, then sometimes it's hard. But I think some businesses don't even have that. So they, for example, miss the whole pathos part. Because they say, oh, I'm going to go in and I'm just going to tabulate. You know, I'm going to send a survey and we're just going to look at the numbers. But you need those human conversations. And I'll tell you another story of, we did another home visit with a customer in the Bay Area. This really nice condo in the downtown San Francisco. And the woman had been a model before and now she was a researcher. And we go in and there's clothes everywhere and you first think, okay, that's probably a kind of a messy person. Turned out that was her way of knowing what she has. Right? A very smart product person would say that's a need. Somebody, the actual need is knowing what you have, because when you have the clothes in the closet like this, you don't know what you have. Right? And then you have somebody standing in front of a cramped closet and say, I have nothing to wear. Right. So that's number one. And then number two was very interesting to me. That's a great example of a true insight. You know, you would think that if you feel depressed or down one day, you would dress kind of like a Italian grandma, right? Maybe, right? All black, maybe. What she said was the opposite. She said, sometimes if I feel down, I put on a exceptional piece of clothing and people start talking to me. And that brings my mood up. So quite the opposite. And I said, that's an aha.
I think with that, we can start to wrap up. To me, first of all, I've really enjoyed this conversation, Alex. Oh, I think
likewise.
Hearing your perspective, the thing that I took away that, you know, I think, look, I'm not an insights person. Samrat's an insights person. You're an insights, a data person. I'm a creative first. So I'm looking at how you're positioning your work. You're right. Trading in data. You're arriving at insights. You need to sell it. And I think the idea of anecdotes, that word is not used very much in the rooms that I've been in. The word itself, it comes up in different ways, right? Like, let's put a lot of consumer quotes in there, right? But they're looking for consumer quotes. They're looking for verbatims. Not necessarily. An anecdote is something meaningful. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And also something that is related to their experience as a consumer that will shed light on a topic or on an issue, a problem. And so I think the idea of anecdotes, thinking in that framework, really kind of resonated with me as a storytelling tool, right?
You're absolutely right, Corey. And then the other thing, which has to do with the way we use language, is many times anecdotal, and that's probably, you've heard that in your law career. Oh, it's anecdotal evidence. Well, what does it mean? It's not true. It's not the norm. Right, so to me, that's a big distinction between doing research to prove a point and doing research to create something new. And I think very few companies, unfortunately, we talked about how you convince people. You have to look at the big picture of how like society works and business works, and which is now companies are bound to this 4-month reporting, right? Juggernaut. 4 months, you have to make a number and then everything backs into that, right? You have to make that number. So many times you give an insight, and then the right way the decision maker is they're going to help you make that number next quarter. No,
right.
So that's the sad part. But I'll leave you with one saying that goes to that point, which is: don't use research and insights like a drunk man uses a lamppost for support, not for illumination.
And, that's a great one. Summer, I'll give you the last word on that, buddy. That's a good one.
I love the journey that you've taken, Alex, much because it mirrors some of my journey. I started off creating a theater company when I was 20 years old, feeling on that, but realizing that creativity is the passion and finding solace and insights, but also a mind there that added it to the heart. I feel like, you know, everything that I've heard today has been representative of a person who's grounded in academia, salted by experience. At the end of it, when you think about why you do this, what you do, what would you say the reason is?
I mean, I would say that we need more humanity in business. That's my mission, is to humanize business. And we need a bit to bring humanism back and to soften that technology edge a little bit.
Alex, listen, really appreciate your time. It was an honor to have you on the show. And it, you know, got me thinking. Samrat, my friend, I'm feeling inspired.
Inspiring Insights is powered by Stories Bureau. This episode was produced by Alexander Uresta with help from Mather DeLeon. It was engineered and mixed by Tim Ballant and was edited by Joshua Ramsey. if you're into the show, why not follow Stories Bureau on LinkedIn, where you'll also find Corey and Samrat. And visit storiesbureau.com to learn more about how we tell stories that empower insights for companies all over the world. We'll be back in a month with another insightful conversation that'll inspire you to go beyond the job description. Until then, thanks for listening.